The first case for argument this morning is Wendell versus the city of Marion, Indiana. Mr. King.
Yes. May it please the court, good morning. My name is Peter King, and I'm counsel for the appellant, Chauncey Wendell. We are here today as a result of an appeal involving the summary judgment entry by the trial court on the substantive due process rights of a child whose rights were violated, involving a substantive due process right of she was molested and psychological abuse, we say through the complicity of defendant state actors. At this point, Chauncey will request and would ask the court reverse the lower court ruling of summary judgment. The state has a compelling interest for the protection of abused children. This court very eloquently stated that standard and talked about it in the opinion of Pecci versus J. Sterling Morton High School. It talked about how a child oftentimes has no way out as it relates to psychological abuse, cannot report the abuse. Oftentimes the abuse is invisible to other third parties, and that the state has a responsibility to protect those children who may not voluntarily do so on their own. So as a result, we start with a premise that this court clearly and quite properly says we cannot blame the victim in this case, who is the child who was abused in this case. This case represents what we think is a classic exception to the DeShaney opinion that this court authored and then went up to the Supreme Court, and it deals with the implication of the state-created danger.
Has the suit been filed against Rigsby?
Beg your pardon?
Rigsby, the state actor who actually committed the abuse.
The suit was filed in state court. It's pending. It's stayed pending the resolution of this issue. But
Why would that case be stayed pending the resolution of this one?
Your
problem is that this suit is against people who may have failed to protect your client from Rigsby, and there is a state actor who has seemed liable on the facts as recited here, but it's not these defendants.
Well, this case is, Judge, in all due respect, about other state actors who were complicit in the molestation and the psychological abuse of the child. In fact, this circuit in DeShaney talked about how complicity of a defendant, of a state actor, may hold and be responsible for liability under the substantive process clause. In fact, Bank versus...
There's no substantive due process clause.
Right. Well, the substantive due process rights pursuant to the due process. But the point is, in Bank of Illinois versus Over, you all indicated that if there was actual knowledge of placing a child in danger by social workers, then the DeShaney exception does not apply.
Wait a minute. I mean, first of all, the Supreme Court's decision, DeShaney, that we are certainly obliged, just like every other court in the country, to follow. And I'm concerned about where this duty to protect comes from. You have the Indiana Code that's got various reporting requirements. And I suppose we have two possibilities. Number one, it was not complied with, and does failure to comply equal a substantive due process violation? As you know perfectly well, the mere fact that state law isn't complied with doesn't mean that there's a federal constitutional violation, but sometimes there is and sometimes there isn't. But if there's some other duty that police officers have to protect children when problems come to their attention, where does that come from? Where is it in the law?
Well, at first, I think I would look at the analysis that there's no question that the child here had a due process right of liberty as it relates to freedom from having her bodily integrity invaded or abused.
Well, but so did Joshua in DeShaney.
Yes.
I mean, he was being horrendously abused, and he had the same right you're describing, and yet the particular state actors that were sued, the Supreme Court told us, could not be held liable.
Based on the facts of those cases, and it's critical that we look at the facts of this case, because that's when I talk about complicity. That is the actual knowledge that the city and the officers had of the abuse. The record will show, as we go back to as early as September of 1997, which is clearly two months.
That's actually part of DeShaney, too. It's part of the holding that there's no duty to prosecute crime. I mean, you seem to be saying that it's a constitutional duty to arrest anyone who's known to be committing a crime. And it was part of the holding of DeShaney that there is no such duty.
Well, again, I think the factual distinction here is very, very critical. DeShaney does not involve a set of facts where the court found, nor did this court find, that the social workers had actual knowledge that there was abuse occurring.
Part of the discussion in DeShaney is the question, is there a duty to arrest people known to be committing a crime? The court said no. The DeShaney case is not limited to Joshua DeShaney. There are general principles there. And that's why I'm puzzled that you haven't brought into this case the real state actor who actually committed the wrong. Now, if there was a claim of conspiracy between that state actor and the police, you would have a much more powerful claim, but bringing this suit and leaving the teacher out makes your case, makes your job very hard.
In all due respect, Judge, what I'm trying to say is that there can be multiple state actors who contribute substantially to the constitutional violation. And as I read DeShaney and saw the language concerning complicity, and complicity means an accomplice, somebody who helps or allows this other state actor to accomplish its purpose. And clearly, the police listening in, knowing the name of Chauncey, Chauncey, the record tells us, is a very unusual name in that community. The record tells us the officers knew that it was an inappropriate sexual contact with horrible, sexually graphic language between this adult female that they knew to be a teacher at a middle school and the name of a child by the name of Chauncey that is so rare, that this went on, by the record, at least for 2 months. And nothing happened until the officers sensed desperation in the voice of the child and then acted. To me, that framework is so extraordinarily different from DeShaney, where the court found that though there were suspicions, there wasn't actual knowledge, and it's the actual knowledge here that brings this case into the complicity, that brings us to the violation by this state actor.
I'm not sure if it's actual knowledge, though, that's the difference. I think what you're trying to find out, or what you're postulating, is that when the police, as state actors, essentially allow an abusive situation, whether it's a child being abused or whether it's watching somebody being beaten or whatever, to be fodder for their own entertainment, it's like they're watching a movie or something and not realizing that it's real people involved. Is there something different about that situation? Nobody said the social workers in DeShaney enjoyed the fact that Joshua had bruises all over him and was plainly at risk, and I think the court thought he was plainly at risk. In your case, as I understand your argument, you're saying that there was a salacious motivation on the part of the police to listen to these tapes until they suddenly realized, hey, wait, this is serious, you know, we better step in and do something. I don't know how that fits into the due process arguments that you're making, because I can certainly see there might be an Indiana code problem, I can see other issues, but why is that substantive due process?
Well, Judge, you're exactly right in the sense that the record of fair reading is that this was entertainment for the third shift in Marion, Indiana, and very tragically so for a period of 2 months, that it was entertainment. And as it becomes entertainment to these officers, they become complicit, and the complicity makes them an accomplice. And the accomplice makes them a state actor that is part of the cause of the deprivation of the constitutional right. It clearly brings it full circle in terms of causation.
What did they do to create the danger, Ms. King?
Well, every time that they allowed it to continue as they participated in the entertainment, they are an accomplice. And an accomplice, by definition...
The creation of the relationship?
Well, the accomplice creates it each time. Anne Presnell, the psychologist in the record, said that each time the child is abused, the psychological harm as well as the physical harm escalates and is ongoing, and each time there
sorry? Counsel, if I'm a bank teller and I know that the teller next to me is embezzling from the bank, does that make me an accomplice?
Well, you're not a state actor at that point.
Look, the concept of being an accomplice doesn't depend on being a state actor. I'm just asking whether, as a matter of general legal principles, knowledge that somebody else is committing a crime makes you an accomplice in that crime.
Not being a criminal lawyer of any nature. What I'm trying to say is it's a causation concept. If the court is worried about extending liability to...
The teller blowing the whistle would stop the crime.
It's certainly under that, your hypothetical, that's a reasonable suggestion.
So would that person be an accomplice?
If that person knowingly allowed it to continue?
In state law, being an accomplice to a crime is itself a crime. It makes you guilty the same as the principal. So I'm wondering whether your approach produces a very large increase in the range of the criminal law.
What I'm trying to focus on is the constitutional.
I understand you're trying to focus on it, but you're using principles like the idea of being an accomplice that have meaning elsewhere, and that's what I'm trying to pursue.
Okay. What I was trying to elucidate here, if I could, is as I read DeShaney, the court specifically talked about police officers who would be complicit in the beatings, and that may be a substantial, the kind of factual basis that could substantiate the finding as an exception to DeShaney in terms of no liability. So it is the accomplice part. It's the part where they're participating, although vicariously, not with knowledge. The violation of the state statute would be indicative of their indifference.
Well, they did nothing, Mr. King, to stop the horrendous conduct. But how did they aid it, either in the initial creation or it's ongoing? They just didn't, or are you saying by not stopping that, in effect, the aiding or accomplice situation you wish to establish?
By not stopping, and with knowledge, understanding what is going on, they help the molester, the other state actor, accomplish her end, which is the psychological and physical abuse of the child.
What about law enforcement, which in some ways permits crime to go on and attempts to get bigger fish, you know, the kind of involvement that's sometimes done with drug cases and where sales are permitted in the attempt. I mean, they could stop it, but they don't because they're trying to get higher up the chain of who's a major seller. Are police officers complicit in crimes in that case?
Well, in that case, I'm not certain how I would answer without looking at the criminal statute, but for example, in this case, their complicity and...
We're trying to ask hypotheticals about other cases, and you really need to deal with them. I mean, let me give you a concrete example that arises in a sting operation. The police set up a fencing operation. They offer to buy stolen goods. One of the consequences of that is that it gives thieves an incentive to go out and steal. And they do. Are the police running this fencing operation liable to the householders whose goods are stolen?
Judge, maybe what I should do is reference the Dykstra case, as I understand this court's opinion in 2001, dealing with a fellow who was a drug dealer, who got involved with the police and said, hey, I can help you do drugs, and eventually got involved in a bad transaction. He claims the police set him up and didn't protect him, and this court said, look, he had knowledge. He knew exactly what he was doing. Those sting operations may have those same factual circumstances of knowledge.
The householders whose goods are stolen don't have any knowledge of the sting operation, nor for that matter do the burglars.
And to that extent, then, I suppose the question would be, who is the claimant who's claiming the violation of the sting?
In my hypothetical, the householder whose goods are stolen by the burglar who's selling to the FBI.
And the householder would not be a knowing and an intentional person involved in that process?
Of course not.
Right. What I'd like to just reserve the balance of my time, if I could, Judge. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Keene.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Bob Keene here for the appellees in this case. And I think that the Court has hit on what the critical issue in this case is. The theory that is being advanced by Shanti Wendell in this case is that there was constitutional obligation on the part of the police to protect her from the abuse that was ongoing by Ms. Rigsby, the teacher.
If Rigsby were a jail guard, this would be a perfectly clear case for liability, would it not? If the captain of the jail guards refused to stop a subordinate guard from sexually abusing a prisoner, this would be a slam-dunk case for the plaintiff. So why is it different if the abuser is a teacher rather than a jail guard?
Two important distinctions there. One, that in that case the victim would have been in the custody of the government. And there's
a lot of people who think that students are in the custody of the government. students especially.
But I think the courts have held that there's not the same special relationship between children and school officials that there exists between inmates who are in jail. The second distinction that's important to note in your hypothetical is in that case the supervisor would be supervising the person who is abusing or offending the person's rights. Here there's no employment relationship whatsoever between the teacher of a separate legal entity school corporation and a police officer in the city of Marion.
Yeah, but that makes an awful lot to turn on the organization of the government. If the government creates a second bureaucracy, call it jail guard supervisor agency, so that there's one agency is the jail guard agency and the other is the jail guard supervisor's agency, you would say they were in two separate bureaucracies.
No, because this is a separate legal entity under Indiana law. They have no relationship whatsoever.
Yeah, I'm asking you to suppose that a state creates a separate legal entity called the Jail Guard Supervisors Agency. Would that mean that so far as the Constitution is concerned, the jail guard supervisor now has no obligation to intervene when the jail guard sexually abuses a prisoner?
Assuming in your hypothetical that the supervisor has an obligation under law to supervise that official, that would create a nexus that doesn't exist here.
The plaintiff relies on a supposed state law obligation to intervene in cases like this.
But that's not what Indiana state law says. Indiana state law simply says that the police officer must make a report. Anyone must make a report to Child Protective Services if they learn about potential child abuse. There's no obligation under state law to do anything in particular to intervene, remove the child, or anything on the part of the police officer under these circumstances.
Mr. Keene, let's remove it from Sergeant Rayner and in the hypothetical, think about either the sheriff or the Indiana State Police overhearing it. Is that any different than in this case we've got the school, the city, and its police force? In other words, do we have a closer nexus because these are officers of the
municipality
where the education is conducted?
Yeah, it doesn't, because I think it's important to note that this is not a city-run school system. This is a separate legal entity under Indiana law that's established by statute under Indiana law as a school corporation that has nothing to do with the city government itself. Separately elected officials and appointed officials and employed officials. So these are two separate legal entities. So whether it was state police or sheriff's officials or federal government officials that overheard these conversations, there's no greater or closer relationship between the city police and the school teacher.
Different question. Do you think that if the police department identified a house of prostitution, which I presume is illegal under Indiana law, and they set up cameras and they made films of the people who were patronizing that and the things that happened there, and they showed them every Saturday night at the police social event so that the officers could watch what the cameras had recorded, do you think the rights of anybody in that house of prostitution, either the customers or the prostitutes, would be violated?
The cameras would be looking inside the house, or just who was coming or going?
They're X-rated films, essentially.
Okay. You have a question there about whether there's an invasion of privacy argument there, whether the action of the police actually invaded the privacy of those people in a place where they had an expectation of privacy. I don't know whether that would be the case or not under this hypothetical. It would depend on how intrusive the camera was into the premises. It was actually inside.
I'm it's pretty intrusive.
Okay, well, assuming if they put the camera inside the house, and then filmed what was going on inside the bedroom in a house of prostitution, I think there would be theoretically a potential claim for invasion of privacy on the part of the individuals there because they had an expectation of privacy in that room.
Right. What I'm trying to get is, are there any substantive rights of those people violated? Because as I see it, something analogous is being asserted by the plaintiff here. There is the police radio that's picking up these sexually explicit conversations, and instead of either turning the radio off or following the provisions of the Illinois reporting statute, notwithstanding whether it was a legal interception or not, or doing anything else, the police for some period of time sit around, just like my hypothetical of the people at the Saturday night movie showing, and they just listen because they find it entertaining. Why doesn't that violate some substantive rights of the people who are being used as entertainment? Well, unbeknownst to them.
The distinction here is twofold. One, in that this is a substantive due process claim, not an invasion of privacy claim on the part. They're not complaining they shouldn't have been listening to these calls. They're complaining that the police didn't intervene to stop the conduct, the abuse that was ongoing. That's an important distinction from your hypothetical. In addition, the calls were over airways that could be heard by anyone that had a radio that could pick up those transmissions. So it wasn't inside someone's bedroom when the police went in and put cameras into this home where there would be an expectation of privacy for people in that bedroom, and you wouldn't be no expectation that anyone else would be aware of what was going on or could view what was going on. The fact that film was made and then shown is also a critical distinction. There's been no argument here that that was done or that these conversations were recorded and replayed and anything like that.
But they are listened to. I mean, the fact that it's watched once versus, or listened to once versus numerous times, I think is not a big difference.
But going back to what the 14th Amendment due process provision limits, it limits the power of the government to harm people. That's what the 14th Amendment due process clause provides, is it limits the power of the government to harm people. It doesn't require that the government protect people from each other. And that
unless perhaps the person who harms the plaintiff is a state actor. Right? The critical question in this case is, does agency A of the government have a constitutional duty to stop agency B of the government from inflicting harm on a private person? The harm in DeShaney was inflicted by a private actor. The harm in this case was unambiguously inflicted by a state actor.
True. I agree that there's a distinction there, but none of the cases that have interpreted DeShaney since then have found that one government agency has a constitutional obligation to protect citizens from the act of
others. My question is, why does it matter how the government chooses to organize itself? What the 14th Amendment applies to is the state. And the fact that the government chooses to organize itself in a lot of little boxes doesn't seem to me a very good reason why box number two would be insulated, when if it were all one continuous hierarchy, it would not be insulated.
I think it goes back to a practical distinction made that the police don't have the authority, the city police don't have the authority to control the actions of everyone else that works for the government. That would require then that, for instance, if a city police officer in Marion knew, overheard telephone calls of some involving some teacher in Indianapolis, say, at a totally different location, that police officer would have some constitutional obligation to go down and intervene and protect that student from some abuse by a teacher in another part of the state. As a practical matter, that police officer has no control over the actions of that other state actor working for another state agency. And in cases where the courts have held some obligation to intervene, it's where the defendant had some right to control the actions of the abuser.
It doesn't matter, Mr. Keene, whether this call, Raymer, was informed by Larry Shaw or another teacher at the school, right? I mean, if another teacher had overheard
right.
this in that community and called Raymer, that wouldn't have been no responsibility.
No, under DeShaney, it doesn't matter how the official learns of the criminal acts that are ongoing. DeShaney holds that the government doesn't have an affirmative obligation to intervene.
Why doesn't it constitute, in this setting, a report of a criminal conduct by somebody? Why isn't Shaw telling Raymer that there's a criminal conduct going on and is asking? I mean, he just informs them about the conversation. He
right.
make what I'm suggesting is
right. And in fact, as it's developed, this isn't like everything was determined all at once, exactly who was talking to whom and what the relationship was and how old people were and who they were. I mean, this evolved over a period of time, bits and pieces of information from these phone calls. So, but I think under DeShaney, it doesn't make any difference how the officer Raymer learned of the potential criminal act that was ongoing. DeShaney says he has no obligation to intervene. And I think the critical distinction here or issue is if Raymer hadn't heard these calls at all, no one had heard these calls, and this abuse had gone on, would Chauncey Wendell have been any worse off than she otherwise was? Wouldn't all of the abuse still occurred that happened to her? In fact, it was only because Raymer intervened that the abuse stopped at all. Otherwise, who knows how long it would have continued to go on. And that's the holding of DeShaney. Unless the police make the situation worse than it otherwise would have been, there's no constitutional violation under due process. There's been no showing whatsoever that Raymer or any police officer, Marion, made the situation any worse than it otherwise was going to be by anything they did.
That's the thrust of Mr. King's argument. At some point, duration can impact whether or not it becomes worse.
Certainly the duration of the abuse can impact how much the victim suffers. But the police did nothing to cause any of that abuse to occur, to encourage it, to act as a conspirator in it.
They don't help sustain it once they're possessed of the kind of knowledge that they had here?
No, they don't help sustain it. They simply fail to intervene. Their argument is failed to intervene to stop it. That's totally different, because DeShaney says that if the same thing would have happened if the police weren't involved and didn't know, then there was no state-created danger, no increase in the harm to the victim because of state action.
So if you're not there at the creation of the danger, it doesn't matter when a state actor picks up information?
As long as that state actor doesn't do something that it makes it easier or protects the abuser in some fashion, in the cases where police officers stand by and watch someone be beaten, that's a different situation.
What's
because
the difference?
They're there.
What's the difference between this overhearing, assuming it's not a false representation, and a visual sighting, according to your example, if they stood by and watched it? What is the difference between standing by and watching the beating and listening to this over a sustained period of time?
Because it could be argued that by standing by and watching the beating, the police not intervening, that might discourage other private citizens from doing so who otherwise might if the police weren't standing by. Certainly if one police officer is beating a suspect while other police officers stand by, that's a totally different circumstance as well.
You need a neighbor looking out a window at two officers in a squad car watching someone being beaten and do nothing about it for us?
Well, presumably, if a neighbor looks out the window and sees someone beaten and there's no police around, they're going to call the police and have the police come. If the police are already there and they're not doing anything, what does that tell the neighbor? Doesn't do any good to call the police. They're already here. I better not intervene. The police aren't doing something to intervene. There must be a reason for that. So that's why there's a distinction when they're present on the scene while the conduct occurs. And there's been no evidence whatsoever that Raymer or any of the police officers did anything that enabled the abuser to abuse the victim in this case. That was going on before they knew about anything to do with this. It continued to go on. In fact, there's been no argument or showing that either the teacher or the student had any idea that the police were listening to these calls until after intervention occurred. So the critical factor that Judge Lee found in granting the summary judgment at the district court level is the police did nothing that made this situation worse than it would have been. That's what DeShaney says the rule is. Courts interpreting DeShaney have so held since then. This isn't an exception. It doesn't fit in the state created danger exception. It doesn't fit in the special relationship exception. There simply is no exception to the DeShaney rule in this case, and for those reasons, we'd ask that you affirm the entry of summary judgment in favor of the defendant in this case.
Thank you, Mr. King. Mr. King.
Thank you, Your Honor. Quickly, there is evidence in the record that the police did do something. They essentially directed. You remember that Lieutenant Alter Dunn was directing Officer Henderson, who knew something sick was going on and wanted to act because he knew Chauncey was being molested. She directed him not to do anything, which in the end means that the Office of Family Children under Indiana law would not do an immediate site investigation, which would have changed the plight of Chauncey Wendell greatly.
Do you think that brings this case? I think the case you need to answer is Monfils, in a sense, because that's the case where the police do, in fact, take an extra action that makes the man who's eventually killed significantly worse off. You know, they release the information after they promise him they won't. I suppose my question is, what in your case, other than perhaps this directive to continue to do nothing, looks like the Monfils situation?
Well, in addition to doing nothing, then Raymer misled Lieutenant Alter Dunn that he had done something, that is, talked to the prosecutor's office, and also with the fact that, again, I keep saying that they knew that this was going on, and so they, in essence, each time this child is molested, the harm escalates and the desperation escalates until they arbitrarily decide on November 24th, 1997, they'd heard enough because the child is desperate and we better do something. That is an arbitrary exercise of power in the Due Process Clause when they had a state law responsibility to affirmatively act. because of the very unique circumstances, factual pattern in this case, where we have actual knowledge of abuse to a child psychologically and physically, a department that had seemingly used it for entertainment until it became to a point where they believed that she was desperate. This case is a case that represents factually an appropriate cause of action under the due process clause implicating the substantive due process rights, because as Justice Brennan says, and to paraphrase him, our Constitution is not so indifferent to indifference. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. King. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the second case of the day, Newsom versus McNally. Et al. Mr. Rosenthal.